Welcome to the Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty podcast. In this episode, Baptist Joint Committee Executive Director Brent Walker examines how government accommodates religion without advancing it. This is the second presentation for the 2013 Walter B. and K.W. Sheridan Lectures on Religious Liberty and Separation of Church and State. Walker delivered the lectures on the campus of Stetson University in DeLand, Florida.
Yesterday, we discussed what I had called first principles, some theological and historical antecedents to our understanding of religious liberty today. And now I want to talk about our first freedom, which is religious liberty, gifted by God and protected in our Constitution, specifically in the First Amendment and the first two religion clauses in the First Amendment, and examine how those two clauses operate together, sometimes in tandem, sometimes in tension, to ensure that religious liberty that we have inherited from creation when God gave us that liberty, and also that we have, and the constructs that we have inherited from our forebearers, the founders of this country, who fashioned the First Amendment to protect that God-given freedom. Yeah, so it is the first freedom because of the fact that God gave it to us a long, long time ago. But it's also the first freedom because it's embodied in the first 16 words of the First Amendment to the Constitution, the Constitution's Bill of Rights. Right smack dab up front, right before speech, before press, before assembly, before petition, all important freedoms protected, but our founders thought it important to talk about religious freedom first. And beyond that, it was not just another freedom that was protected like the others. It was protected with a double-barrel dose of protection. Two clauses, not one. One for speech, one for press, one for petition, one for assembly. But we've got two provisions, two clauses that protect our religious liberty. No establishment and free exercise. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And both of these are important provisions. Both must be taken seriously. And both must be rigorously enforced if we are to adequately protect the God-given religious freedom that we enjoy. Let me make two general observations before we get started, or as a preliminary matter. First of all, let me say that religious freedom in America is threatened by the wrong-headed belief among many that religious disputes ought to be settled by majority vote. I think we hinted at this a little bit last night in response to one of the questions. Now, although majoritarian principles are fundamental in a democracy, and that's how we settle most of our political and policy issues, the Bill of Rights generally and the First Amendment's religion clauses in particular are what Justice Sandra Day O'Connor called counter-majoritarian. They're counter-majoritarian. They ensure the rights of minorities, even a minority of one, and protect against what is sometimes the tyranny of political majorities. They depend for their efficacy on the outcome of no election. As Sandra Day O'Connor also said, actually she wrote this in a concurring opinion in the second Kentucky Ten Commandments case bill, that one of her final opinions before she retired several years ago, she said this: "We do not count heads before enforcing the First Amendment. Doesn't matter how many heads there are, how many hands there are, how many levers are pulled in the voting booth, or how many, I guess, chads are punched. No, it doesn't matter. These are valuable protections that exist and obtain no matter what other people think or do, or how they vote, or how powerful they're able to assemble their opinion. So this counter-majoritarian understanding of the protections for religious liberty require, as I said, a robust application of both of these religion clauses. If either clause is collapsed into the other, or if both are kind of watered down into a muddle of majoritarianism, religious liberty surely suffers. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But secondly, the second preliminary matter, and it's related to the same subject, this majoritarian attitude that Justice O'Connor rejects is directly related to the deceptive notion of what is often called religious equality. Now, to be sure, all religions should be treated equally, one with another. The government shouldn't prefer any religion over another. But when government treats religion the same as secular pursuits, we sometimes get into trouble. Religious liberty is best ensured when government treats religion differently, sometimes extending religion a special concession, and sometimes imposing on religion unique constraints. Religion and religious institutions are often given special concessions to lift burdens on the exercise of religion. For example, a Baptist church is allowed to hire a Baptist music director instead of a Buddhist. For-profit businesses cannot discriminate on the basis of religion in hiring, treated differently. Corporate lobbyists on K Street in Washington, D.C. must register under the Lobby Disclosure Act. Lobbies on Capitol Hill, religious lobbies, are exempt. Secular nonprofits like the United Way are required to file Form 990 at the end of the year, disclosing a lot of information about their operations. Religious nonprofits, generally speaking, are relieved from this burdensome requirement of filing a Form 990. Houses of worship are exempt from having to install ramps and elevators under the Americans with Disabilities Act. Secular public accommodations, like the Comfort Inn where we're staying down the street, must apply. Now, we would hope that churches and religious organizations would comply voluntarily, but the point is they are exempt from having to do so as a matter of law in the Americans with Disabilities Act. And there are hundreds of other examples where religious institutions should be and often are given special concessions to accommodate the free exercise of religion. On the other hand, sometimes religion must endure unique constraints to prevent the establishment of religion, or at least to ensure compliance with establishment clause values. For example, a public school teacher can say the Pledge of Allegiance in class, can recite the Gettysburg Address, may voice many, many other things, obviously, in the classroom, but they may not lead in prayer or preside over religious exercises. Government buildings can display a portrait of the President of the United States, but they may not display a portrait of Jesus or display the Christian cross. Government may fund many things, including the public schools, but it should not directly fund religion or religious schools. So these limitations on religion operate to ensure government's neutrality vis-a-vis religion and promote religious liberty for all, particularly religious minorities. Well, unfortunately, the present trend in this country, in the culture, and in the judiciary, is to defer to the will of the political majorities, even where the rights protected by the Bill of Rights are implicated, and to treat religion the same as any old other secular pursuit. This attitude is precisely what informed the Supreme Court's disastrous 1990 opinion in Employment Division versus Smith, the Native American peyote case. The court's majority held that religious claims were not entitled to strict legal scrutiny, not entitled to exemptions from neutral, generally applicable laws. Religion should be treated no differently than secular counterparts. Five members of the court concluded that this is simply a, quote, unavoidable consequence of democratic government, end quote. Do you hear the majoritarian impulse there? In effect, the court told disappointed religious claimants to take their case to the legislative branch, the quintessential majoritarian political institution. And the court has slowly chipped away at the principle of requiring some constraints, especially concerning the public funding of religion. For example, the court has upheld the furnishing of computers and other educational equipment to church schools, and under certain circumstances approved the use of school vouchers to support religious education. Again, the attitude that has accompanied this march down the primrose path of government-funded religion is the misguided notion that religion should be treated the same as and equal to other pursuits. Well, this majoritarian idea of religious equality demeans religion at every turn and undermines religious freedom. When one levels the playing field for religion, no one should be surprised when religion gets leveled in the process. To quote Melissa Rogers, who used to work at the Baptist Joint Committee, Holly's predecessor, and now is the head of the White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. No, religion is special. Religion is different, and treating it as such is what is necessary to preserve religious freedom. As soon as it just collapses into a mushy middle of majoritarianism, you lose that distinctiveness and you lose the protection that should go along with it. Well, having said that, let's begin with some basics. Both of the First Amendment's religion clauses, no establishment and free exercise, are essential to ensuring religious liberty. They stand as equal and counterposing buttresses, if you will, upholding the wall of separation between church and state as the means to the end of ensuring religious liberty for all. A proper understanding of the institutional and, to some extent, functional separation of church and state requires government to accommodate religion, but without advancing it, protect religion, but without promoting it, lift burdens on the exercise of religion without extending religion an impermissible benefit. Well, let's take free exercise first, the second clause. Again, we have talked about the wisdom and sometimes the necessity of granting concessions or exemptions to laws that apply to everybody else in order to facilitate the free exercise of religion. Well, these religious exemptions generally fall into one of three categories. One, mandatory exemptions. Two, permissible exemptions. And three, impermissible exemptions. And let me take each one of these one at a time. The first one, accommodations may be required or mandated when government has placed a substantial burden on the exercise of religion. These are usually dispensed by the courts where the burden violates the free exercise clause or some overarching religious liberty statute such as the Religious Freedom Restoration Act passed to recreate by statute a traditional understanding of the protections afforded by the Free Exercise Clause. Government can avoid this obligation only if it can show that it has a compelling governmental interest for doing so. So examples of these mandatory exemptions are demonstrated in several Supreme Court cases involving the excusal of Amish children from compulsory education laws. The Amish are excused for religious reasons from sending their kids to the public schools past the eighth grade. Giving Seventh-day Adventist unemployment compensation benefits while allowing Mrs. Adele Sherbert to refuse to work on her Sabbath. Grace, you know about that case, don't you? affording Santerias in South Florida the right to engage in the practice of animal sacrifice, which they regard as a sacrament in their worship, even though other people are not allowed to kill animals under the animal cruelty laws. Those are all of this to say that where government regulation would violate one's free exercise rights, the courts and sometimes the legislature generally must provide an exemption to remove that burden unless government has a sufficiently compelling interest for refusing to do that. A really good interest. Remember yesterday when we were talking about the colonial constitutions in the various colonies, how they required exemptions for religious exercise, but they had those outs, those safety valves. But you know, when there was peace and safety considerations, when there is civil injury to others, when there is that licentiousness to be spread around, then, but only then, could the government say, no, you can't do that. You can't practice your religion in that way. So this compelling interest feature of our modern understanding of the free exercise rights under the First Amendment kind of stand in that tradition that we talked about yesterday in colonial times. So, mandatory. Other cases involve situations where accommodation may not be required, but for policy reasons, legislatures may decide to exempt them anyway. These permissible accommodations will lift some governmental impediments to religious practice, even though those impediments may not be substantial enough to trigger constitutional rights. Examples of these kinds of accommodations are seen throughout federal and state law. They include tax exemption. Generally, tax exemption is not mandated by the Constitution, but it's permissible for the Florida legislature to give it to you, or the IRS. Various other tax breaks, such as the ministerial housing allowance and exemption, as I mentioned, from annual reporting requirements in the Form 990, the presumption of tax exemption for churches. Churches don't have to file the Form 1023 like everybody else does, that big old form, to get the IRS to exempt them from taxes. A church holding itself out as a church or a house of worship is presumed to be exempt. Special protection against invasive governmental audits, the Church Audit Procedures Act, that government officials have to go through the various protective procedures before they can come in and audit your books. Another example involves an exemption to the Civil Rights Act of 1964 to allow religious organizations to discriminate on the basis of religion in hiring, even with respect to non-ministerial personnel. Religious organizations are often exempted from nettlesome land use regulations and zoning laws that impede a religious organization's ability to discharge its ministry and community service under the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. And the Supreme Court has ruled that states may provide financial aid for ministerial students in colleges and seminaries, even though they are not constitutionally required to make such aid available. Doug Laycock, a law professor at the University of Virginia that we work a lot with a number of years ago, did some research and discovered some 2,000 religious exemptions in federal and state, all 50 states counted, state laws. Most all of those were these permissible accommodations. Now, I hope Doug had a good teaching assistant or researcher, because that sounds like an awfully tedious task to go through all the law books in all 50 states. But yeah, over 2,000 of these permissible accommodations for religion, not constitutionally required or mandated, but they are permissible to help facilitate the exercise of religion. And that's one reason, among many others, why I get so tired of hearing people talk about the religious persecution in this country. You know? I mean, there is religious persecution in this world, and it's abominable, and we need to fight it. But, you know, for somebody to, you know, with religion being treated so generously in our laws, don't always get it right, but most of the time we do. to say that religious folk are being prejudiced or persecuted, to me, is the granddaddy of all overstatement. Well, sometimes an accommodation is neither mandated nor permitted. These involve ones that actually advance religion rather than accommodate it, actually promote religion rather than just protect it, actually provide a palpable benefit rather than lifting some kind of burden, and therefore they often violate the Establishment Clause. Yeah. You've taken free exercise down the road so far that it has actually bumped into the Establishment Clause, and the law will say you can't go that far. You can't accommodate to the point that you're actually advancing religion. Now, we're going to disagree where you stop accommodating and start advancing, stop protecting, start promoting. But that's the theoretical line that divides permissible exemptions and impermissible exemptions. Examples of these impermissible exemptions are a Connecticut law that required employers to grant leave to workers upon request for religious observance. And the U.S. Supreme Court said that went too far. It had violated the Establishment Clause in large measure because that law would prejudice the rights of employers and burden the rights of other employees that were not requesting a religious accommodation. To require religious accommodation rather than to make the employer act reasonably in the face of these requests went too far and actually violated the Establishment Clause. And the court has also struck down attempts on the part of states to exempt religious periodicals from sales tax because they were deemed an indirect subsidy and elevated religious speech to a higher level than comparable secular speech. Remember, we said tax exemption is a permissible accommodation, a permissible exemption, but when you do it only for religious periodicals, for religious speech, the court said that goes too far and actually amounts to an establishment of religion. Well, it's helpful, I think, for us to keep these three kinds of accommodations in mind when we analyze free exercise claims and examine free exercise controversies and try to fit them into one of the three: mandatory, permissible, and impermissible. Well, the most controversial free exercise issue today, and one that I want to talk about for a few minutes, it involves the requested exemption from certain parts of the Affordable Care Act, the new health care law dealing with contraception. So I see a lot of heads going up and down, and you've heard about this and thought about it with the in the media for the past several months. That law, of course, requires employers with at least 50 employees to provide insurance coverage, including contraception, for women employees who desire to obtain it. The law initially exempted churches and other houses of worship with conscience-based objections to contraception, but it did not exempt religiously affiliated employers, not churches and pervasively religious organizations, but religiously affiliated employers like hospitals, colleges, universities, Catholic social service charities, and others. Many religious liberty advocates, including the Baptist Joint Committee, criticized the administration's failure to offer a broader accommodation. You know, we said, so far, so good. Yeah, you ought to exempt churches and houses of worship, but that's not broad enough. You need to go find a way to go broader. And later, to its credit, the administration announced a modified policy that sought to do just that, to strike a balance between the conscience rights of religiously affiliated employers who objected to forms of contraception and the public interest of ensuring that all women have access to preventive health care who desire it. And under the under the revised rules, objecting employers will not be required to offer or pay for the employees' health care plans that cover contraception, but insurance providers must make such coverage available to all employees who work for employers who choose not to provide it. And a one-year safe harbor provision is currently in effect, exempting religiously affiliated employers with objections to contraception coverage from complying, and that runs through August of 2013, to provide a window to continue to negotiate this difficult proposition of how you respect the conscience of one party while trying to protect the well-being of another party, in this case an employee of the same organization. Well, in February of this year, the administration also announced additional rules to clarify and expand the definition of religious employer and to detail the process by which self-insured employers could be dealt with in a way that gets them off the hook in terms of a violation of conscience, but still provides insurance coverage. And the administration has come up with a plan that allows third-party administrators that administer self-insurance plans to work with health insurance providers to extend that coverage, that, again, providing some distance between the employer and the employee's desires to obtain contraception coverage. The Baptist Joint Committee has taken the position that these accommodations are certainly permissible and perhaps mandated by the Free Exercise Clause, and were a politically reasonable effort to strike a balance between the rights of employees who desire coverage and those employers that object to it. You know, many religious affiliates, including some Baptist colleges and agencies, have sued, claiming that these accommodations are insufficient, and these cases are working their way through the court. Some are being thrown out because we're in that window through August when nothing is really quite final yet, and some courts say it's not ripe, but other cases have gone forward and decisions are varied in how they come out, at least in the initial stages of the legislation. Well, in addition to the accommodations for churches and religious affiliates, some have gone even further in their request for exemption and accommodation. Some owners of for-profit commercial businesses, often doing business as corporations, have taken the position that they too should be accorded an exemption on equal footing with religiously affiliated non-profits. And here too, litigation has broken out on various fronts in a variety of jurisdictions, and I think that the U.S. Supreme Court will eventually have to decide that issue, because there's disagreements among the local the lower courts on this issue as well. As a general proposition, individuals should not have to choose between their conscience and their chosen profession or business activity. The Free Exercise Clause and the various statutes, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, can sometimes be asserted to obtain an accommodation even in an otherwise secular context. You don't want to be working for a church or a religious affiliate to exercise your free exercise rights. But the argument here against extending accommodation to for-profit commercial enterprises is that any burden visited on the conscience of the owner is at best remote and tenuous and not substantial as required for relief under the Constitution or federal law. The argument goes, having to pay premiums to an insurance company to cover a panoply, a full range of medical services, with the employee, who after all was hired without regard to her religion, the employee making her own independent determination about whether to use contraception, is arguably too attenuated a connection to substantially burden the owner's exercise of religion. As I said, the Supreme Court's going to have to decide that issue because it is a pretty much an issue of first impression. This law and this issue highlight a really important concept. Many accommodations of religion, whether permissible or mandatory, visit no harm whatsoever on third parties. These include, for example, exempting members of the Native American Church from laws banning the use of peyote. Doesn't bother anybody else if the Native Americans can chew peyote as a sacrament in their worship. Allowing the Amish, as we have said, to be exempted from compulsory education laws. It doesn't harm you and me for the Amish up in Wisconsin to be able to take their kids out in the sixth grade. Excusing some religious groups, the Hmongs, Orthodox Jews, from participating in autopsies otherwise required by law. The same thing. These are easy accommodations to make, ones that don't affect anybody other than the claimant seeking accommodation. Far more difficult are cases where, as with the Affordable Care Act, the rights and well-being of third parties are directly affected by the requested accommodation. And that's when it gets tough and the government has to come in, the executive branch in enforcing the law, the judicial branch in interpreting the law, and balance the equities, balance the rights involved in these very difficult cases. And even if the court were to find that there is a substantial burden in the first place, courts may also find that government has a compelling interest in protecting the welfare of those third parties, in this case, women employees who desire contraception, and hold that such an accommodation would, in fact, go so far as to be a violation of the Establishment Clause. So, pretty complicated issue. The Baptist Joint Committee is continuing to struggle with it and to help advise the administration during this one-year period following the litigation in the cases. And one day, I'm reasonably certain one of those cases will find its way across the street from our offices in the halls of the U.S. Supreme Court. Having mentioned the Establishment Clause, let me now segue to that part of the First Amendment. So far we've been talking about free exercise. Now let me talk for a few minutes about the Establishment Clause. Again, we have said that the Free Exercise Clause sometimes requires certain concessions to be made to religion. Well, the Establishment Clause sometimes requires certain constraints to be imposed on religion for government to maintain its neutrality and to ensure religious liberty. If the Free Exercise Clause keeps government from trying to hurt religion and sometimes requires accommodation, the Establishment Clause keeps government from trying to help religion. You see how these two balance one another out? No helping, no hurting, just leave it alone is the best way to deal with religion and ensure religious liberty. Changing the metaphor ever so slightly, Dean Kelly, a wonderful Methodist pastor of a generation ago, also a tough advocate for religious liberty, once observed this, and I like the way this sounds, and it makes good sense to me. He says, government may and sometimes must get out of the way of religion, but government should never try to get behind and push. To me, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, government ought to clear the way out. Sometimes an accommodation is required. Get out of the way of religion. Don't mess with it, but certainly don't try to get behind and push. Ensure free exercise, but don't establish religion in the process. We talked yesterday about what I think the founders meant by the Establishment Clause. Let me briefly sketch out what the thinking out there is today. Some people take what I call a narrow or weak view of the Establishment Clause. People in this camp say that government cannot coerce religious choices, requiring you to do something your religion forbids or preventing you from doing something your religion requires. They understand the language in the First Amendment only to prevent government from preferring one religion over another or from setting up a single national church like the Church of England. But they would allow government to aid or promote religion generally, if even-handedly. Some of them, including one member of the U.S. Supreme Court, Clarence Thomas, see the Establishment Clause as simply a federalism provision, a federalism cleaver, if you will, to keep the federal government from interfering with state establishments. And we talked about that last night again in connection with a question that the Establishment Clause applies to the federal government and to state and local governments, but he would see it differently in a much more limited fashion as not protecting much of anything at the federal level, but keeping the federal government from messing with state establishments. And, of course, if you take that argument to its logical extension, we could have 50 different state establishments in this country of religion. And I think that's completely outside of the realm of reason or possibility. Others, including the Baptist Joint Committee and myself, take what is often called a broad or bold or strong view of the Establishment Clause. As I argued yesterday, it sees the language of the First Amendment to prevent government from endorsing or aiding religion in general, not just a ban on denominational discrimination or outright coercion or setting up of a single national church. And again, one of the most compelling arguments behind that view is that our founders considered specifically and rejected four proposed amendments that would have expressly allowed government to advance religion generally, even if it did it even-handedly and didn't favor one religion over another. Well, this strong view that we hold has generally been one that has prevailed in the United States Supreme Court. In fact, the Everson case decided in 1948, the first modern Establishment Clause case, in that opinion, all nine justices, this is 1948, all nine justices embraced this broad view of the Establishment Clause. Even if they divided 5-4 on how they would apply it in that case, in principle, they all agreed that the Establishment Clause doesn't just prevent denominational discrimination, doesn't just prevent coercion, prevent setting up of a single national church, but has broader application to prevent the government from advancing religion generally. I'm distressed to say that the court today is pretty much evenly divided. No more 9-0 on that issue. It's pretty evenly divided, sometimes 5-4, sometimes 4-5. Every now and then we'll get a 6-3 decision. When Justice O'Connor retired and Justice Alito came to take her spot, the calculus shifted on that score, and now it's more often 5-4, 6-3 against us on the fundamental understanding of the Establishment Clause, and that's terribly unfortunate. Establishment Clause cases tend to fall into one of two general areas. First one, concerns are raised when government expresses an official opinion or takes sides in matters of religion. It has to do with attempts by government to promote or endorse religion in words or symbols. These cases involve, for example, government displays of the Ten Commandments, a state-approved prayer and religious exercises in the public schools, government-sponsored displays of creches and other religious symbols. The second general category of Establishment Clause cases has to do not with what government says or endorses, but what government does with its checkbook, or your and my checkbook. These are the funding cases that involve claims that government establishes religion by supporting religious organizations, programs, and enterprises with tax dollars. And examples of this include attempts by government to subsidize religious ministries through the so-called faith-based initiative, efforts to fund religious education, as was attempted here in Florida last fall through the failed effort to repeal the no-aid provision in your state constitution, providing aid to rebuild the churches damaged by hurricanes and Sandy. This past fall, government cannot promote religion through what it says, its symbols, its words. Government cannot promote religion through what it does with your and my tax dollars. Okay, free exercise, no establishment. Now, I want to conclude with a short discussion of a third area of church-state jurisprudence that really does issue from both of these clauses, no establishment and free exercise, and it's called the church autonomy doctrine. Basically, it says that government, particularly the courts, must defer to religious organizations to make their own decisions about matters of doctrine, internal governance, polity, and administration. This so-called rule of judicial deference usually comes up in cases arising out of employment disputes with religious organizations and property ownership issues surrounding church splits. The doctrine also means that the courts are supposed to define religion only when it has to, and then expansively and generously, and are absolutely barred from judging the truth, the validity, the reasonableness, the consistency, the orthodoxy of religious beliefs. This is an important part of U.S. law that protects the integrity and autonomy of religious bodies. A case in the U.S. Supreme Court just last year called Hosanna Tabor, you may remember it, dealt with this principle. In this landmark decision, the High Court upheld the so-called ministerial exception, a specific application of the church autonomy doctrine that prohibits courts from intervening in employment discrimination disputes between churches and their ordained ministers. Well, when dealing with a local church and its ministers, this rule was pretty clear-cut and makes a lot of sense. Far more problematic in this case was the fact that it dealt with a religious school, not a church, and with a teacher who had secular as well as religious duties at the school. In addition to secular subjects, the commissioned teacher, which is pretty analogous in the Missouri Synod Lutheran denomination to ordination, the commissioned teacher also taught religion classes and led in many sacerdotal activities, leading in daily prayer and devotional exercises and participating in school-wide chapel services. So it was a commissioned, ordained teacher, not a pastor, who had both of these kinds of responsibilities. And the court below said, well, let's weigh them out. Let's see which is 51%, 49, 51, secular, 49, religious, or the other way. And then whichever one weighs out, that's the way we'll go. Well, the Supreme Court took the case. And in a unanimous opinion, again, we don't do unanimity in the court on these kind of cases, but this one was unanimous, 9-0, said that, no, the court, you can't weigh this stuff out. It held that she was a ministerial employee based on the circumstances of her employment, and as such, she could not file a discrimination suit against the school when it fired her for reasons that might have otherwise violated the Americans with Disabilities Act. No, you don't weigh them out. If there are any substantial religious responsibilities, the court said, 9-0, we're going to apply the exception. Chief Justice Roberts, writing for the court, observed that, quote, the interest of society in enforcement of employment discrimination statutes is undoubtedly important, but so too is the interest of religious groups in choosing who will preach their beliefs, teach their faith, and carry out their mission, end quote. And Chief Justice Roberts concluded that a church must be free to choose those who will guide it on its way, end quote. And I'm glad to say the Baptist Joint Committee, through the good efforts of Holly Holman, filed a brief in the case, pretty much making that point with the court. Happily, it was a 9-0 decision, with the most conservative and the most liberal justice agreeing on this church autonomy doctrine application to the ministerial employees such a very important concept. Because where it applies, there is really no balancing to be done. We've said in free exercise, you got to balance the interest of adversely affected third parties. Establishment clause, you've got to do some balancing. Where you get into this church autonomy doctrine, the courts pretty much have to defer without much equivocation or balancing to judging theological and ecclesiastical matters, to leave that up to the decision making of the body in a way that it sees fit under its tradition. I mean, some will decide those issues hierarchically: Catholics, Episcopalians, Methodists. Some will decide those issues congregationally: Disciples, Baptist, etc. But the point is, they get to decide their destiny when it comes to matters of theology, internal operation, and how they choose to do church. Well, I began this lecture by talking about the counter-majoritarian nature of the two religion clauses and their protection for religious freedom, with a footnote on the church autonomy doctrine. I want to conclude by giving somewhat of an ironic twist to that assertion. For this counter-majoritarian understanding of the First Amendment's religion clauses to survive over time, in the long run, it must be embraced by a majority, if not a consensus of the American people. Not just by judges, not just by smart advocates, not just by the media, not just by academics, but in society generally, we have to buy into that concept. After all, a counter-majoritarian constitutional provision can be changed by a supermajority if they can get enough votes. And it may be hard, it may take a long time, but it can be changed if there is not some general consensus on how we resolve these issues and on the importance of the counter-majoritarian aspect of these rights. I think popular acceptance of the counter-majoritarian principle and the idea that religion needs to be treated differently on both sides of the equation can be encouraged through appeals to a sense of fundamental fairness and maybe common courtesy. I've often propounded something that I think would do us a lot of good if we would get serious about applying it. And it's akin to the golden rule, and sometimes it's referred to as a golden rule of church-state relations. And it's something, it seems to me, we should all be able to rally around, believers and non-believers alike, from left to right across the political spectrum, because the golden rule is so darn reasonable, isn't it? Not to mention biblical. And my golden rule for church and state would go something like this. I cannot ask government to promote my religion if I don't want government to promote somebody else's religion. And I cannot permit government to harm somebody else's religion if I don't want government to harm or hinder my religion. You know, if appeals to history and theology and constitutional principle and all that doesn't do the trick, then maybe this appeal to, what shall we say, enlightened self-interest, maybe? Maybe it will. I mean, this patently reasonable application of the religion clauses would support a regime where a government protects all religion and all religions and promotes none, ensuring religious liberty for all of us in the years to come. So accommodate religion, yes. But advance religion, no.
That was Baptist Joint Committee Executive Director Brent Walker delivering his second of three presentations for the 2013 Walter B. and K.W. Sheridan Lectures on Religious Liberty and Separation of Church and State. All three presentations are available online in both video and podcast form. For more on the Sheridan Lectures, visit our website at bjconline.org/lectures.